All right, so we said we're going to talk about today is the Yom Kippur War. Now, even though Israel eventually wins the Yom Kippur War in, anyone know what year? 1973. Okay, Yom Kippur 1973. Even though they actually win the war, it goes down as one of the biggest tragedies in Israel. Israel was caught by surprise. We suffered lots and lots of casualties. The government is blamed. There's commissions that were set up to, you know, place blame, who's at fault for what happened. And we'll have to figure out what happened. So October 6, 1973, Syria and Egypt simultaneously invade Israel. Syria coming down from the north, Egypt coming up from the south, crossing through the Sinai. And Egypt crosses through the Sinai. Syria recaptures the Golan Heights. Everything that we got in the Six-Day War, we lose. We lose. The size of the attacking armies equals the combined forces of NATO and Europe. Now, because of the religious holiday, many Israelis were sent home to go home and be with their families for Yom Kippur. And there was a very small force that was on the borders. So you had like 100,000 troops that are coming, Egyptian troops that are coming across the Suez Canal, and they are opposed by a few thousand soldiers that are spread, you know, out, and what we'll talk about soon, the Bar-Lev lines. Egypt soon overran them, and the Golan as well. Syria makes rapid advances. Now, in retrospect, their thought was, oh, we'll attack them on the holiest day, symbolic, they wait for that day. It turns out that it was to Israel's advantage, because even though there were so few people on the roads, it was easy to contact any soldier. This is before people had cell phones. So everyone was either at home or in shul, and it was easy for the military to get hold of them. Not only that, the roads were clear. No one's on the roads, so people were able to mobilize very quickly and get to where they needed to get, whether it be in the south or up in the north, in a very quick, you know, a very, very short amount of time. Yeah?
Do Syria and Egypt deny that they plan
to do anything? No. This is a strategic attack. Now, within a week, Israel had driven Egypt and Syria's forces back to where they were before the war began, but the price was horrifying. More people died in the first day of the Yom Kippur War than the entire Six-Day War. And by war's end, four times as many people. 2,700 Israeli soldiers were dead. Like I said, four times as many who had died in the Six-Day War. This is a very difficult war. It was a war that we eventually won. It was a very difficult war. Now, what happened was, whatever people felt before the war politically, they continued to feel it with gusto after the war. So if, let's say, you were a left-wing dove. So you argued, had Israel been more willing to compromise territory after 67, the Arabs never would have gone to war. And the right-wing hawks would say, oh, thank God we didn't compromise territory. Otherwise, instead of like just making their way through Sinai, they would have already been in all sorts of Israeli towns in no time. So everyone continued to feel how they felt. And the big, you know, movements that we'll talk about next week, let's say, I don't know, Gush Emunim or Peace Now, right wing and left wing, respectively, they come into power after the Yom Kippur War, when you would have thought, oh, they probably came into power right after the Six-Day War, when we tripled in size. But actually, it was sort of low-key until the Yom Kippur War, and then each person came out, you know, saying how important my view is, and everyone should agree with me. The Prime Minister at this time was Golda Meir. Defense Minister was Moshe Dayan. They will come under harsh criticism. In the end, both of them will be forced to resign. Chief of Staff David Al-Elazar, known as Dadu Al-Elazar, he kept requesting military. He said we need to do a preemptive attack. He felt that a war was imminent, and he kept getting rebuffed. Now, why? I mentioned this before, that had America been the chief supplier of arms in the Six-Day War, when America warned, don't go to war, Israel might not have gone to war. By 73, America is the chief supplier of arms to Israel, and America is saying, don't even think about going to war. And therefore, even though there's lots of intelligence reports that are saying that a war is imminent, Golda Meir doesn't want to fire the first shot, doesn't want to do what we said in 67, that preemptive defensive attack, for fear of incurring the wrath of the Americans. So things actually, you know, that's certainly part of it. As I told you, there will be an Agronaut Commission. The Agronaut Commission, very cool. I only found this out recently. This was a Supreme Court justice. He runs this commission a month after the war. And sitting on this commission of people who are deciding the fate of Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, et cetera, is Rav Nevenzel's father. Rav Nevenzel's father, he was on this commission. That was pretty cool. I never knew that up until recently I heard this. Okay. Yeah. So earlier we mentioned that Kennedy started sending us some stuff and then he died and Johnson continued, but it's because Israel has been giving America, we said before, they captured a Soviet radar station. They captured a Russian-made MiG. All of this was intelligence that the United States wanted to know about their arch enemy, the Soviet Union. So it's a quid pro quo, right? We're defeating you intelligence. We're helping you with that. So America started to become now. They didn't give us weapons. We had to buy them, right? And there's also all sorts of loan guarantees that America did, naming that they would be co-signing on loans so that we would have money to do things. So it wasn't like giving away, but there was a relationship. And in many cases, Israelis had to go to America to be trained. So there was some, you know, relationship, how to use things. So the relationship started to grow. Okay, we'll see exactly what happens here in the Yom Kippur War to our, let's see how to put this. It did not work in our favor that the Secretary of State of the United States was a Jew. All right, Secretary of State for the United States was Henry Kissinger. Okay, he was a Jew, born in Germany, moved to the United States. Golda Meir once made fun. She was meeting Nixon and said, oh, look, your Secretary of State and my foreign minister, hers was Abba Eban, they're both Jewish, except that mine speaks English a lot better than yours. So Nixon wasn't happy with that. Okay, here's the thing that led to the Yom Kippur War. In Israel, it's known as Hakonsepsia, the conception. What was the conception? The intelligence community assessed that the probability of a joint Syrian-Egyptian attack was extremely low. This is what they said. Didn't matter what they were seeing, all sorts of buildup by the Syrian-Egyptian armies moving on the borders. They said it was maneuvers. And didn't matter that King Hussein warned them there's going to be a war. What happened? Sadat called a meeting. Three countries. Assad from Syria. Hussein from Jordan. And Sadat, who took over, he had taken over Nasser, had a heart attack, and Sadat took over in 1972. He called this tripartite meeting, and King Hussein, burnt once in the Six-Day War, decides that he is not going to be a part of it. Not only is he not going to be a part of it, he warns Israel there's going to be a war. But the intelligence community says it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. This is what this is how they convince themselves. How much so? Even though a decision was made to beef up the regular army in the Golan Heights, and they put the Air Force on alert, Prime Minister Golda Meir didn't cancel an official trip to Australia, scheduled right after Rosh Hashanah. She flew off, business as usual. Didn't matter that Egyptian and Syrian forces, you know, were moving tanks up to the borders. The intelligence branch kept saying it's not going to happen. Right? This is sort of like Cheta Maragu. Right? There's two parts to intelligence. One is the gathering of, you know, the material. The other is the analysis of it. The gathering did not mess up. They were getting information. But The analysis was way off. Golda Meir had no military experience. She relied heavily on her military attaché, and they kept telling her, all good. Moshe Dayan was in Time magazine in 1972, saying there will be no major war in the Middle East for at least 10 years. Okay? The head of military intelligence, General Zeira, said Syria and Egypt will only... Syria is too weak to start up with Israel. They'll only do it if they join together with Egypt. And Egypt got whooped in the last war, and they're for sure not going to do anything at least till 75. Only then will they have upgraded their planes. And of course, we're not going to be standing still, so we have nothing to worry about. Okay? Totally ignore the fact that Syria moves all the... Yeah. Well, like I said, Jordan could very well be that King Hussein felt Hakara Satov, that Israel helped him when he put down Black September, he put down the PLO uprising. Could be he didn't want to, you know, lose face again like he did in 67. So he preferred to stay out of things. Iraq sent troops. Morocco sent troops. Even Jordan sent some troops. They sent it up to Syria. They didn't get involved. They didn't open up a third front like happened in the Six-Day War. But they did send some troops, a couple of hundred soldiers, up to Syria to help them. They shouldn't look like, you know, they weren't there. They weren't part of it. But they didn't get involved. Like I said, Iraq sent some troops, and Morocco sent troops, but they didn't send armies. They sent soldiers to help out. Now, the IDF intelligence branch ignores the fact that Syria is building up on the border. And why is Syria building the border? So we mentioned this before, 13 MiGs got shot down in a dogfight a month earlier to one Israeli plane. Okay, one Israeli plane to 13 MiGs. Syria is upset. They're moving up troops. So what does General David Al-Azhar say? We got to call up the reserves. But Moshe Dayan says, no need. Tells Golda Meir, no need. 2 days before Yom Kippur, dramatic report from extremely reliable source. They have it checked out. They send like the head of the Mossad to check it out. Comes back, it's going to happen. And still, Israel's preparing for a quiet day at Yom Kippur because they don't want to rock the boat. This is what's going on. Now, here's the interesting thing. Israel had a double agent. Okay, Ashaf Marwan was the son-in-law of Nasser, former prime minister, you know, president of Egypt. Had a heart attack. Now Sadat's running the show. But Nasser, son-in-law, is a spy for Egypt. He is caught by Israel. Okay, caught with the handlers in Europe by Israel. Brought to Israel, and Israel turns him. He chooses to work as a double agent rather than rot in jail. And he goes back now on behalf of Israel to Egypt to feed us information. Okay? Think about it. It would be like the son-in-law of the president, Jared Kushner, is working for Russia, you know? So this is what you have here. You have the General Nasser, President Nasser's son-in-law, is now a double agent. He's working for Israel. He tells Israel, Egypt's going to attack on Yom Kippur. And again, the intelligence community ignores it. Why? They think he's actually now working as a triple agent. Right? Can't trust him. And who knows? Maybe he was. I mean, in the end, Egypt either was really good and Egypt had no clue, but in the end, Egypt gives him a state funeral when he dies. So either they had no idea that he was actually working as a double agent, or maybe he was a triple agent. I don't know. I haven't seen it yet, but Netflix has a movie about him called The Agent. You saw it? Was it good? All right. So...
It wasn't exactly what you said.
What?
It wasn't exactly what you said.
Okay. I haven't seen the movie.
He called them.
He calls...
He calls Israel.
He calls Israel. Okay. From what I have here in my notes... You know, he was caught, and then they turn him. Okay? But no, it could be that, you know, I don't know where the movie is taken from. Maybe they, at a certain point, he's now giving them information after he was turned. I don't know. Now, The Six-Day War changed the way Israel perceived itself. They now became cocky, overconfident, right? They have a huge buffer zone, the Sinai. Any plane that takes off in Cairo, instead of 3-4 minutes, it's going to take 16 full minutes before it gets over, you know, Israeli land area. And therefore, they even changed the way that they protected the Sinai. Instead of having mobile forces, which is always the move, because then the enemy doesn't know exactly where you are, they had 7 stationary places. This is called the Bar Lev lines. Sharon was absolutely opposed to it, but a general Bar Lev, he had this thing 7 miles apart. You couldn't even see one place or another, so it could be attacked and overrun, and no one would see. You can go in between, and no one would see, because it wasn't even enough that you could see from one place to the other. And in the end, it gets overrun. But again, it was out of this cockiness that we're all good. Not, you know, we don't have to worry about it. They built 80-foot walls of sand along the canal so no one would be able to cross the canal and come into Israel. But Egypt figured out how to get rid of it. First they're trying explosives, wasn't helping. And then they just took the water from the canal and they made water cannons. And the water cannons knocked out the sand walls. And they started, you know, coming over with pontoon bridges. And they started bringing over now their tanks into the Sinai. Right? You know what a pontoon bridge is, right? Pontoon bridge is this makeshift bridge. How do you build it? Get a bunch of boats. Let's say you get a line of boats over here, a line of boats over there, and then you put this bridge on top, lying on like half of the line of boats on each side. And based on the water displacement, right, Archimedes' whole idea of, like, you know, water displacement, it can hold up even tanks. Right? So you have all these boats, and you put the bridge lying on top of them, and the tanks can make it from one side to the other. And tanks are now coming over into the Sinai. Okay. Plus, Soviet made these surface-to-air missiles. And there were Soviet-manned missile sites that neutralized the Israeli Air Force superiority. They're knocking out planes. I think, if I remember correctly, I have in my notes somewhere, 100 Israeli planes were knocked out on the first day of the war. Right? One Egyptian writer wrote, if Israel loses 10,000 soldiers, the country will collapse. But Egypt can lose 50,000 and no one will care. And therefore, Egypt planned for a protracted war. Right? We said by the war of attrition, just wear them down. Chaim Herzog, writing about the Israeli intelligence breakdown, called it, possibly saying in Hallel, Einayim lehem velo yiru. They have eyes and they don't see. It was right there in front of them, right? Not just the military intelligence, the Mossad as well. The Mossad was so busy seeking retribution for the people who killed the 11 Israeli athletes in Munich, they weren't watching the mobilization and maneuvers of the Egyptian and Syrian armies. Didn't notice that the evacuation of the Soviet families, right, saying stay out of the way, there could be a war soon. We weren't up on that. Why? Because we were busy off in Europe hunting down the terrorists. Had we sent several hundred tanks to Sinai and the Golan, it's quite possible the war would have looked totally different, or maybe there wouldn't have been a war. There would have been enough of a deterrent that they never would have gone to war, because they would have seen, you know, all the people that are ready. Israeli preparedness would have stopped the war from ever happening. And yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that. Now, with all the information, General Elazar asked for a preemptive strike and he was denied. The NSA knew 3 days before the attack that there would be, that war would break out. They intercepted a phone conversation from Egypt, but the Nixon administration ordered them to sit on the info. Kissinger, the Jewish Secretary of State, wanted Israel to win, but in his words, to bleed first, to make the negotiations easier for him. And Nixon himself was preoccupied with Watergate, so Kissinger was running this. Now, Bruce Brill, who was an NSA analyst, who later made Aliyah, always felt responsible for the lives lost because he didn't pass the info on to Israel. All right? He basically wanted to be a Jonathan Pollard. He wanted to, you know, tell Israel what he knew. He didn't. And he feels responsible for all these lives lost. As I told you, more soldiers died on the first day than the entire six-day war. Now, Dayan felt, I'm saying, how bad was it in the first days? It led to Egypt declaring themselves victorious. They celebrated year after, even though they first made it, and then they had to go all the way back to behind the, you know, behind the Suez Canal, and Israel maintained full, you know, the entire Sinai. Since they inflicted so much pain on Israel, beginning of the war, even though it all changed after about a week, they celebrate October 8th annually as their victory over Israel. Right? Now, this led to the eventual peace with Israel and Egypt between Sadat and Begin later on, which we'll speak about, because Egypt felt that they saved face. They couldn't come in. They were too proud to come in and say, all right, let's make peace now that you whooped us in 67. But after we now held our own, now with pride, they were able to say, okay, now we could talk peace. So in a, to a certain extent, you know, depending on how you feel about the peace treaty with Egypt, this led a lot to the peace treaty with Egypt. The war became so bad that Moshe Dayan felt the need to retreat, even if a ceasefire would have us lose much of the land. Now, here's this interesting thing. As I mentioned, Sadat takes over for Nasser. Nasser has a heart attack. And throughout 1972, Sadat is calling it the year of the decision. This is it. This is the year. And he keeps bragging, this is the year we're going to show Israel who's boss. And day after day, and nothing happens. So as far as Israel is concerned, he's all talk. All talk. Now, what's interesting is, you have a lot of political analysts that say Sadat was known to be very cunning. And it's possible this is all part of his plan. So cunning, very smart, devious. And therefore, this might have been part of his plan to lull Israel into a state of complacency, saying, like, you know, all bark, no bite. So therefore, when once again he starts maneuvering tanks, they go, all right, yeah, Sadat. Everyone knows Sadat. You know, he's all talk. Okay, now you have also the opposite. General Dadu Elazar, in May of 1973, he felt with the Egyptian army on high alert, he ordered a call-up of the reserves. And like 80,000 soldiers were called up, and they sat around, and nothing happened. And he was criticized, roundly criticized, for squandering public funds, inconveniencing thousands of Israelis. So what happened to him? When he then again comes Yom Kippur, a few months later says, they're going to attack, he became the boy who cried wolf. He said, that's what you said in May. And nothing happened. So we have two things working simultaneously. The distrust of, you know, Sadat being sincere, and Dadu al-Azhar being an alarmist. Those two things together, and the intelligence community kept saying, Moshe Dayan saying, let them come, I'll step on their necks, they're nothing compared to us. Everyone's saying, yeah, you know, of course. You know, who's going to mess with us? Just so you should realize how popular Moshe Dayan was. I went to Madame Tussauds Wax Museum in the 70s. Okay, I don't know if any of you guys ever been there. Right, very famous space. Millions of tourists go through there. So they did this survey. I had this book. It was a fantastic bathroom book called The Book of Lists. Okay? And this one was just from there. And from 1967 to 1973, Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, top five people annually, greatest heroes, greatest villains. Hitler made greatest villains every year running. Only two people made heroes every year running. Jesus Christ and Moshe Dayan. Now, I know Israelis like to travel a lot, but it wasn't the Israelis that was stuffing the ballot box. It was that everyone looked at Moshe Dayan and said, he is David against Goliath. And Moshe Dayan says there's not going to be a war, or if he says, let them come, I'll put them down. So every Israeli said, yeah, what am I scared of? Moshe Dayan says, we got this, we got this. And this was the overconfidence that Israel had, right? All the intelligence coming in saying there's going to be a war, and Moshe Dayan, together with military intelligence, saying nothing to worry about. Okay, now, when the Bar-Lev lines are overrun, the 16 fortifications are overrun, there were only 436 soldiers there. 436 soldiers. Almost all of them, Milu and Nikim, right, as we said, just wanted to get back to their families. None, hardly any of them had military experience. You know, it's only 6 years since. And now it's like the people that came up after the Six-Day War, they're doing reserve duty, young families, and they have no war experience. They're captured. Also, lots and lots of religious soldiers. Why? One of your jobs, let's say you're in the army chaplaincy. One of your jobs, Kobe, who davened for us this morning, that was his job in the army. He was part of the Rabbanut in the army. So one of the things, obviously, that you do is you kasher the bases, and certainly for Pesach. But all of these soldiers, you had a lot of religious soldiers who were sent to these places so they should have minyanim for the Yomim Noraim. People went to make sure there should be a minyan, and you should have someone that could be a Shliach Tzibor. So you have pictures in the newspapers of soldiers being taken captive holding Sifrei Torah. Okay, this is what happened here. They just know what type of people were we dealing with. Okay, they were prisoners of war that told of the horrific treatment both in Syria and Egypt. Just one case in Syria, one soldier took, he went and he beheaded 20 soldiers. 20 soldiers, he beheaded them, went up and down, they had them all on the knees, beheaded 20 soldiers. They started eating parts of their bodies. And this guy was given then a medal by the Minister of Defense in Syria for his bravery. You know? So these are like the type of people that we're dealing with, and now they're marching on us and they're capturing our soldiers. Pretty scary thing. Now, in Sinai, they move in. There's hardly anything there. Israel now has a column of tanks that are starting to try to get there to help out. 100 tanks are coming, but they go right into an ambush. 77 are knocked out by Egyptian fire. And if that sounds bad, it's worse in the Golan. 1,400, there's no big Sinai buffer. 1,400 tanks are now driving down towards the Kinneret. And they're met by 57 tanks. That's it. A helicopter unit goes and retakes the Golan Heights with the very important radar installations that are there. It's now taken over by the Syrians. And really, some unbelievable bravery by the people in the tanks over there stop a massacre. Okay, one soldier in a tank, one tank. He acted as if he was a battalion of tanks. He kept radioing, you have a battalion of tanks up. All right, you over there, take up, you know, position over there. And you three tanks, take up position over there. And he made sure that they would all hear, okay? And for 40 straight hours, I booked that background music for today. 40 straight hours, this tank fought and took out by itself 30 tanks. Right? 30 tanks by itself. Now, as I said, the Air Force got hit the hardest. What happened was like this. Right after the Six-Day War, Egypt violates the international agreement and they move these new SAM, you know, surface-to-air missiles right along the Suez Canal. Now, according to the agreement, there should be an 18-mile buffer zone. But they defy that. They move them right up to the Suez Canal. Israel goes and they complain. And the United Nations tells them, including the United States, forget about it, just ignore it. Because of that, 100 planes were taken out. Because any plane that was coming to Sinai to try to give air support to the tanks, boom, missile, taking them out. So finally, Golda Meir comes up with a plan with Dado Elazar, And what they do is they retreat. They retreat from the Suez Canal 30 miles east into the Sinai and fight there. Why? The surface-to-air missiles cannot reach the planes. And now, with the air support, the tanks were able to fight their tank battles and Israel's able to turn the tide of the war. This is all a strategic idea that they needed to turn the war around. How bad was the war in the beginning? It was so bad that Moshe Dayan came running to Golda Meir and said, it's Churban Bayit Shlishi. And she originally was going to go let him speak, you know, to the public, and she said, forget it, I'm not letting you speak. You're hysterical. And she sent this other person from intelligence who talked about how Israel has taken up, that we were hit hard, we turned, you know, we had a retreat, but at this point we're now on the offensive and Egypt is on the defensive. He had to give the people some morale, something to look. Moshe Dayan was like, oh my God, I blew it, you know? I misread everything. So this is how he felt. This Churban Bayit Shlishi was happening. Now, let's see. The Egyptian losses, okay, crazy tank battles take place. There's one where there's 2,000 tanks are involved. Might have been the biggest tank battle in history. And on that day, Israel took out 264 Egyptian tanks and lost 10. Okay? Egyptian losses were severe, militarily, psychologically. The tide of the war is turning. An Iraqi tank brigade was caught in Israeli ambush. All 80 of its tanks were destroyed. And things are starting to turn now for Israel. In the United States, Vice President Spiro Agnew is caught in a corruption scandal. And he's forced to resign in disgrace. President Nixon was disturbed by all these pronouncements, a little to the side, of the Soviet Union, but he didn't want to be dragged into a power confrontation when he was now politically weak. He was aware of Watergate that was about to break. Watergate. I'm sure you've heard about Watergate. I just realized how ridiculous Watergate was. Okay. 1973, the Republican Party was found. Putting bugs in the Democratic offices to learn like the secrets of the Democratic Party, and then they covered it up. Okay, and Nixon knew all about it, and Nixon gets impeached. Okay, now it was ridiculous on so many levels. One, Nixon won in a landslide, and there wasn't anyone that was even predicting a close vote. He demolished, you know, the person he was running against. It was ridiculous that he felt the need, that he needed this advantage. One. Number two, it was a cover-up of high officials. And Nixon, he had this minug, sort of ridiculous thing. He recorded every single conversation that happened in the Oval Office. So there were recordings of him knowing, you know, about everything that was going on, every conversation, which made it worse. And the USSR knew that the United States was weak, and because of that, they orchestrated, now's the time, to have Syria and Egypt do this two-pronged attack, because America's going to be busy with their Watergate, and this is what happened. Now, yes?
What is Russia against
Israel? They're playing, this is like superpowers, let's say, my pawn is going to beat your pawn, right? And it's a slap to America and their allies. Now, Russia is threatening to move fleets in. Nixon starts getting involved as well. And Kissinger wants America to stand aside. See, in the first week, Israel went through all of their weapons. They had no more ammo. And they're pleading with America, we need more ammunition. Russia had already replenished Egypt and Syria. They're ready for round two. And Israel's basically sitting there, we're all out of ammo. We need stuff. And Kissinger was sort of saying, oh, hold off. And Nixon just gets involved. And it's not 100% clear why he gets involved, but he gets involved with a gusto. And up until Trump, I think the average you know, political analysts in America would say that Nixon was probably the biggest friend of Israel historically. You know, some people wanted to argue Clinton, that's how you think about Clinton. But Nixon comes in and he says, all right, we have to arm Israel. And Kissinger tells Nixon, look, we located 3 C-5, you know, cargo planes to transport. And Nixon says, quote, hell, the Arabs will hate us as much for 3 planes as for 300, for everything in the air that can fly. Nixon goes to Congress. He asks for and he receives a $2.2 billion emergency aid for Israel. And between October 14th and November 14th of 1973, 22,000 tons of equipment were transported to Israel by air and by sea. The airlift alone involved 566 planes. And this turned the tide of the war. It was sort of after this that Egypt and Syria said, all right, we don't stand a chance anymore because Israel's restocked. Why did Nixon wake up? Either A, rescue an ally. B, stand up to Russia. You should know that the Yom Kippur War, America went to nuclear alert. Other than the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was the closest that the United States got to a nuclear war. He wasn't going to let Russia push us around. And he says, you're ready, we're ready. And they went to nuclear alert. 3, Congress, media got to Nixon, and maybe 4, and maybe all of the above, to deflect some of the Watergate attention. Right? Let them write something else about me instead of just Watergate. All of them might be true, but whatever the case is, America comes through and sends all sorts of stuff. England, obviously, you know, to buy us, doesn't even let America refuel, but whatever. We'll leave that, you know, for them. The ground assault, you have 2 heroes, one in the south and one in the north. In the south, it's Ariel Sharon. In the north, Avigdor Kalani. Ariel Sharon leads this unit of tanks. It's a crazy thing. We talk about the sand walls, right? So he doesn't have the water on his side to blast the cannon. But Ariel Sharon never thought that this Bar-Lev line was a good idea. And he said, there's going to be a time where I'm coming back. So before he left this area in 67, he already planted. He tells guys, go look in this area for red bricks. What? They go look and they find these red bricks. This is where he had earlier dug out this whole big 80 thing. It's basically a facade and the whole thing is empty. So they knock it down. In a couple of minutes, they knock it down. They have this open place. And they have these, they build their pontoon bridges. But not just that. They had this crazy contraption that won a Pras Yisrael, 600 by 200 foot roller bridge, this crazy bridge that was rolled through the Sinai by tanks. Tanks are on its side, shooting, fighting people as it rolls this whole thing to the Sinai. And now you can have multiple tanks getting across this, you know, getting across the bridge, not single file pontoon bridge. And he gets his tanks coming up. No one's expecting over here. So there's armies on this side, on this side. He goes and he flanks behind them. And he cuts them off from water, from fuel, from ammunition. Egypt's 3rd Army is cut off. 45,000 soldiers, 250 tanks. They're cut off from food, from fuel, from supplies. Takes out the SAM missiles. He crosses going west when the Egyptian army was going east. He gets within 100 kilometers of Cairo. Sadat's calling Moscow, says, I don't know what's going on here. Israel's here by Cairo. You know, Soviet Union's dumbfounded. How in the world could this have happened? And Ariel Sharon turns the tide of the war to the point that even Moshe Dayan didn't get this. People were singing Arik Melech Yisrael Chai Chai V'Kayam. He's like this hero of the war. Now, he was like abandoned sort of by the government, and he was upset with them because they didn't give him the okay, but he does things anyway. But that's what happened in the south. Okay, I was once in a restaurant before, you know, he became prime minister when he was just like in the Knesset. Walked to a restaurant, everyone like standing up, starts cheering, Arik, Arik! You know, it's like a hero. All right. Now in the north, you have a crazier thing, Avigdor Kalani. I told you that they have like 57 tanks against 1,400 tanks. So here's what happened. Avigdor Kalani commanded a tank raid that wiped out 300 tanks. Okay? He was like the hero. He was a tank commander, his name like the Black Panther. It was like the second Israeli, like like the thugs that were like second-class citizens. And he said they can't get past the Black Panther. He says when the battle is hard for us, it's hard for the enemy too. We're fighting for our homes and our families, for our land. What are they fighting for? They're just obeying orders. They'll break first. I'll read to you one page. You should know, Avigdor Kalani with three tanks. He held up 140 Syrian tanks. Okay, in the book The Glory that I mentioned to you before, it tells this little story. It's just a beautiful story.
Up north, right?
Yeah. Sinking into battle exhaustion at the first streaks of snow ahead, Amos is the fictional character, you know, in the tanks. Leads his depleted force now down to 11 tanks in all, back towards Booster, this area. His ears are still half deafened by gun blasts. His whole body is sore from getting thrown around as the tank pounds over bad terrain. His skirt is darkened by what he has seen of dead and wounded friends. Guys with shell splinters stuck in their faces, gushing blood. Guys disoriented with shock and pain. Guys weeping from exhaustion and fear. Guys sprawled in pallid death. As he rides erect in his turret, scarcely awake, Amos Pasternak now is an experience we'll never forget. He is all at once overcome by a weird feeling of disembodiment. It is as though he is rested, happy, well, and floating 10 or 15 feet above the rumbling Centurion, the name of the tank, above his own physical self that is standing in the turret and peering through the darkness with persisting battle stink of gunpowder and burning in his eyes. Listen to this line. This is the paragraph that I love. He is down there, yes, but he is also up here thinking calmly and philosophically about the Yemenite Black Panther, about the way Jews have returned home from all over the world in response to the colossal German slaughter and have tightened themselves in the hard fist that is Israel. Amos's own parents are from Czechoslovakia and Germany. His gunner is South African. The driver is a Persian. The loader radio man is Iraqi. Janos is a Pole. The division commander, Raful, is a native-born Sabra. Ramat Kahal himself is Yugoslavian. Even the prime minister was born in Ukraine and grew up in Milwaukee. What a country. What a people. What a fantastic return. How good it is to be fighting this battle. It is all he wants of life right now. Right? We got to go. Let me just finish and say that Sadat is demanding there should be a ceasefire. No ceasefire, just a replenishing. Like I said, America gets involved. Finally, Golda Meir stands fast. No ceasefire till there's a prisoner of war exchange. Get back the prisoners. She stands up only because Sharon was able to cut off the tanks. We're talking about 45,000 soldiers we got here, right? So he gives in. There's an uproar. The commission finds, it's ridiculous, but the commission finds Dadu Elazar, the one who kept saying we need to preemptive attack, we need reservists, he's found guilty. And Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan get a pass. The country's in an uproar. Dadu Elazar dies soon afterwards. He's considered a hero. Golda Meir resigns. Moshe Dayan is forced, can't take over, so it's forced to resign as well. And the Labor Party now has to look for someone who's not tainted by war. And they have to decide between Shimon Peres, a non-military person, and Yitzhak Rabin, who is a military person, but he had been in America. They run for office. Rabin wins, and he becomes the next leader, the next prime minister in Israel. We'll pick it up from there, Bezrat Hashem, next week.